James chapter 4 is a chapter, of course, set in the middle of a very, very practical book. Remember, this is the book that starts with our trials and our temptations. This is a book which, or a letter, which places high value on not just talking about our faith, but actually doing something about our faith. And this is a letter which in each of its chapters has something to say about words and their impact, and then about the need for us, like God, to value persons impartially. That's a big issue in this letter of James. Who's the writer of this letter? Which James are we talking about here?
Jesus'
half brother. All right, we're talking about not James, the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, but James, the brother of the Lord, the James who in Acts 15 is one of the pillars. Galatians 2 calls him one of the pillars of the church in Jerusalem. Had James always been someone who expected his brother to be the Christ?
No.
Remember, there's the time earlier on where we remember that he, along with the Lord's other brothers, they come to get him to take him home because they kind of think he might be out of his mind a little bit. You remember that idea? When this letter, however, starts, James identifies himself, if you'll notice, as the servant of Christ. And that will tell you something about the faith of this man. Now, that also, not the servant, but a servant, if you notice. And that also tells you maybe what his concern in this letter is. Being involved in the church in Jerusalem and understanding something about the ease with which we can get off track in our thinking, from his own experience, understanding that, James is very much concerned with what serving the Lord means practically and personally within the setting of the brotherhood, the church. Now, in the middle part of this letter, the chapter divisions probably are not as I would have chosen them if I had been dividing them up. I think the topic that's discussed for most of chapter 4 actually starts with chapter 3 and verse 2, where the tongue, it's the especially the words of teachers and their impact in the church begins to be discussed. And at the end of chapter 3, James says that the answer to this problem is wisdom. The way that words are to be handled so that there is consistency and healing is for people who say the words to pray for wisdom first. That's the same solution that James has issued to start the letter with regard to temptations and trials. Pray for wisdom. And now, when he gets to chapter 4, the way we have it divided, he hasn't switched gears. He's still talking about the same thing, but he's now dealing with the reality of how things are, apparently, among these people that he writes to. And the reality is that selfish ambition, which has been engendered by people's focus on their own pleasures, has caused the sense of hostility among these people that James calls murdering or killing each other. I don't think he means it literally. I hope there weren't any congregations where people divided up and started trying to kill each other. But I think James often refers to the teaching of Jesus. And you remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said if someone hates his brother in his heart, then what he's done is actually had the same spirit as one who would murder or kill. So that seems to be, and what James does is to then begin to head us down a path which would resolve this situation. Where instead of hostility, there might be a healing of relationship and healthy attitudes. And it covers a wider spectrum. And it occurred to me in my Bible reading this week that there are really four parts of this story. And I want for us to kind of reflect on this in our class this morning. The four steps to this, and I'll kind of divide it as it seems to me to happen in this section. To begin with, the first five verses, there is facing reality about who God is. I think that's really the start of this. It won't look that way maybe to us at first thought, but I think you'll see what we're getting at. This is verses 1 through 5. Let's read them first. Verses 1 through 5. Notice how powerful the language James uses here is. And you get the impression right off he's serious about what he's saying in this passage here. Erica, you up to reading? Would you mind reading this passage for us, chapter 4, verses 1 through 5?
What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly and spend on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend and the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the Scripture says he yearns jealously over the Spirit that he has made to dwell in us?
All right. Now, I'd like you to observe that at the end of that reading Erica just did for us, he mentions attitude toward God three times. I believe he is telling us that the real issue in whatever fighting and quarreling and murdering spirit there is among them is their forgetting that God is God. And that's the reason that I suggest this to us. So let's start at the bottom of this little paragraph and work our way back up through it. The statement in verse 5 is interesting to me because there is not a particular one verse that I could find that says it just this way. There is some question about how the phrase might be translated. Notice the way Erica read it. He yearns jealously over the spirit that he has made to dwell in us. How else is that translated? As some of you have other versions that put it in a different way. There are two ways in which this gets taken. I'm trying to illustrate. Does someone have another reading than what I just had?
I have one.
Okay.
Or do you think that the Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit that he has made to dwell in us.
All right. He jealously desires the Spirit that he's made to dwell in us. Anyone else?
And if the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously.
The Spirit which dwells in us yearns jealously. All right, that will do to help illustrate the two ideas. That one idea is that the Spirit should be capitalized here, and that the idea would be that God places His Spirit within His children, and then that Spirit should understand that God, being who He is, will then care about that in which His, or those in which His Spirit abides, and will not be content, will not take it lightly with their murdering and attacking and hating and being hostile toward each other. That's one way this gets taken. And you remember the Old Testament from, say, Exodus 20, when God introduces Himself in the Ten Commandments, this God who is steadfast and merciful and so forth is also a jealous God. That is, you think of it this way, can there be real deep love while there is indifference about what the object of that love does? Did your mama tell you, I love you, sweetie, and it makes no difference to me what you do? That's not how any mama does it, and that's not how God does it either. It is not possible for God to love us so much He would give His Son for us, and then for it not to matter to Him what we do. And that is the other way in which this idea gets sort of taken is that the point would be being made here that the kind of Spirit that we show in how we act will be something that we could not realistically expect to not matter. We ought to understand, he's saying, that because of who God is, the attitude or the spirit that we use, and whatever we make of the image of God that dwells in us, is going to matter. Now back up one phrase here. At the end of verse 4, he says that whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself what? Now we will need to define what James means by the world here. Or this statement won't make sense. What definition needs to be placed on the phrase the world in order to understand what James is saying? Is he saying other people? Is he saying the beauty of the creation around us? What does he mean by the world?
Apart from God.
Pardon?
Apart from God.
All right, apart from God.
Things not spiritual.
All right, things not spiritual, the unspiritual world. One of the definitions that helps me to understand this is that the world, in the sense it's used here, is used of the system that is ruled, the world system that is ruled by the evil one, or human society as it organizes itself apart from God and against God. It is the way of thinking that has a character about it that is opposite of everything that God is. So, James's statement would make sense then, wouldn't it? You cannot be a friend of that which is opposite God and also a friend of God at the same time, because they are diametrically opposed. If I had a blackboard up here, I could take my fingernails. Are any of you old enough to remember that sound? Erica, did you and Melissa miss out on that pleasurable experience of hearing that? Oh, you can imagine it? Okay. A few times at least. You can't be a friend of that sound and also of all of those who can't stand it at the same time. If there are moral and spiritual actions that are opposite of God, that he can't tolerate because of who he is, you cannot admire those things and adore God at the same time. Does that make sense? Okay, I think so. Now back up one phrase before that, where in verse 4, You adulterous, at the end of, in verse 4, you adulterous people. This is a, what does adulterous suggest to you?
Unfaithfulness.
Unfaithfulness to a covenant, to a holy covenant. All right, so this is a picture Jeremiah uses, for example, Jeremiah chapter 2 and chapter 3, I think you see it. The book of Hosea uses this picture very powerfully of unfaithfulness to God. It's like being married and then the fooling around with someone else. That idea, the same kind of spirit. Now, what James says then is that his readers now have fallen prey to thinking that it won't matter what they do, that they can be a friend of the system that is opposite of God, and they can be faithless to their covenant with him and be happy, get along together. And James is saying it ain't gonna happen. And you're crazy If you think that you can function that way. You need to get real about it. And look at the terms that he uses here. There's the picture of people who are fighting and quarreling and would kill each other, hostile to each other if they could. And they can't figure out why. Why is this happening? Why is this going on? And what does James, what's his diagnosis here about the cause of this? Their pleasures. All right. You are devoted to the pleasures. What's at war among you guys is each one wants to have his own way. It's what a paragraph earlier he calls selfish ambition, chapter 3 and verse 14. Does he mean that pleasures, that it's wrong to have pleasure or to take pleasure?
Depends on what your pleasure's in.
That's right. It depends on what your pleasures are and the role that they play in your life. Pleasure as an enjoyable moment in life is one thing. Pleasure as a ruler is another. It's interesting that the word for pleasure here is the term from which we get the word hedonistic or hedonism, meaning that we give ourselves to our pleasures, that the pleasures rule, that passions have control of our lives. Now the problem is, if I am devoted to my pleasure and you are dedicated to your pleasure, what's going to happen?
Conflict.
All right. There'll be conflict because my good time might run crossways with your good time. All right, Ruth?
Well, it just occurred to me that if God is love, which we all, I think, agree on that, God is love, but when you look at murder, there is no love there.
Yeah.
They're quarreling. There's very little love in quarreling.
all these things that he's talking against, love is not involved in it, really.
All right. That's exactly right. Now, here's a question. If God is love, how can he have enemies? He says, said friendship with the world is enmity against God. If God is love, how can there be any enmity about him?
Because there's things that are not loving.
That's right. He will hate that which is destructive and opposite to his opposite, destructive to that which he loves or those whom he loves. And he'll hate attitudes that are opposite of the kind of love that we're and goodwill that we're talking about that produces well-being. So James uses harsh words to point the road to healthy thinking. And sometimes that's the idea. You have the only way to make a turnaround is to be real about what's going on. And we'll have to move to the next paragraph here, but at least you see that general idea, I hope, in the first few verses here. Now, the second thing that happens is James urges us toward reality about sin and grace. Or I could use seriousness about the ideas of sin and grace. And this would be verses 6 through 10 or so? Yes. 6 through 10. All right, someone read these verses for us here. There's a series of short imperatives in this section, ... that one after another that help to drive home the points that James wants to make here. Should we, who realize, you know, we haven't been letting God be God, we've been devoted to getting our own way and it's caused hurt, should we then just give up and despair over that? Should we just laugh it off and say, well, you know, that's how life is and that's how people are, doesn't matter? No, that's not what his answer to it is at all. Verse 6 beginning. Alyssa, would you like to read?
Sure. But he gives more grace. Therefore it says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you.
All right, thank you, Lisa. Now, I want to start with verse 9 in this case. That doesn't sound too much like that great big Christian smile that we all admire, does it? What does he mean? Does he want us to walk around morose and just completely depressed? Is that what he's made? What he's suggesting here?
Well, just take sin seriously and be really upset about it.
Right. The point of verse 9 only makes sense when you think about what he is suggesting this is the proper attitude about. Right. He wants us to be people who take sin seriously and don't think it's a laughing matter, and don't try to just shrug it off. If life were a situation comedy, there would be a laugh track in the background when sin occurs, when ugly thing happens. That's the way our culture is. What James says is that this is something where laughter should be turned to mourning. Sin is no laughing matter. If we've got fighting and quarreling and coveting and murder among us, that's not something to be comfortable with, is it? That's what he's saying. So what he recommends now is to be just as realist or just as confident in grace as we are serious about sin. Back up to verse 6, if you will. The problem at the end of verse 5, it doesn't end there because he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Now, there is an Old Testament statement I can identify. That comes from the chapter Alyssa wrote on the floor of under my desk in that room in there. Back before the carpet was here, where y'all remember we came over and wrote scripture? She wrote from Proverbs 3. I haven't always practiced that, Alyssa, but I remember that I should. And in that chapter, the Greek version of that chapter, this quote, which by the way both Peter and James cite, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. And so what's the proper course? It's mentioned twice in this little section, when we realize that we've gotten focused on our pleasures instead of God's ways. And that's wrong. And we're heartbroken about it. So what's the proper course for us to take?
Submit to God.
Alright. Submit to God. But the attitude that leads to that is to humble ourselves. Verse 6, remember, to humble ourselves. And then verse 10, humble ourselves before the Lord and He will exalt us. Now, what does humbling oneself mean in practice? That's the question. And again, we could talk about what weevils we are. We go around saying, I'm nothing, I've messed up, I'm nobody, I'm awful, I'm terrible. Would that make God happy?
No.
No. Is that humbling yourself? That's being just as focused on yourself as you were, or as I was when I was seeking my own pleasure. Do you realize that there is just as much of an eye focus in seeking my own misery that there was in seeking my own pleasure? What does humbling oneself mean? Well, look at verse 7 and at the imperatives that are here. Submit yourselves to God. What does that mean?
Obey.
The proper first step is always to obey the Lord. When you know He has said something, do that first. Resist the devil. What's that mean?
Turn from temptations and sin.
How did Jesus do that when He was tempted?
Quoted scripture.
He did what God said. By the way, this is also, when you go out our front doors sometime today up here, notice that I didn't promise you it'd be in an hour. When you go out our front doors, it's written in big letters. Andy wrote this, resist the devil and he will flee from you. I thought that was a good advice. You remember that. What about the next one? Verse 8. Draw near to God. It has a promise to it, too. How would one draw near to God?
Reading His Word, praying.
All right. That's where the disciplines of prayer, reading the Lord's Word, being around the Lord's people. Cleanse your hands. This would mean stopping and doing the wrong thing. Purify your hearts. And then being single-minded. Every one of those has a lesson in it. We had more time. I need to point out that I've saved 4 minutes for the last 2 points. That's not good planning. All right. The next one is be realistic about our speech about what we say about each other. Someone read just that, the next 2 verses for us.
Eight and nine?
Yes.
Draw near to God.
verses 11 and 12.
Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you who judge your neighbor?
All right. Now, again, notice the focus on doing here. And the point is, if you say you believe that the Lord is the judge, then don't talk as if you have already judged your brother. That seems to be a logical statement that's hard to evade. And this is one of the, again, as I say, one thing about James is he stops and says something about our words in each of these chapters, and the baseline for them, for all of these statements, is really in chapter 1, and the idea being someone who thinks he is religious. Chapter 1, verse 26. Notice that statement right quick. What's he say? If anyone thinks he's religious and
does not bridle his tongue,
what does he do?
Deceives his own heart.
All right. And his religion becomes then worthless. All right, that idea. All right, now, the idea that there's one lawgiver, there's one judge, and to speak evil against a brother is to do that. Now, this is a different thing from speaking to a brother and admonishing him or helping him or correcting him. Sometimes I notice We speak evil to other people about brothers who speak evil of us, and that's only to promote a cycle. So what James is trying to do is say, be realistic about what we say about each other, and the next thing is facing the truth about our own lives. This would be verse 13 to the end of the chapter. And this is a sobering thought, but nevertheless an essential one. Okay, verse 13. Does this go to 7 too? Does it have 17 or 8? 17, yes. All right. This is familiar enough that I think we can just read it and you'll see the point. Randy, read this for us.
Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, if you know the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin.
All right, now, most writers believe that this paragraph goes with what is in the first part of chapter 5 about the rich and the possessions. But can you see how this could be tied also with the first part of chapter 4 where people are focused on their own pleasures and asking amiss because they want to spend it on their own pleasures? What would this last paragraph have to say about that kind of action? It'd say it, Ruth.
You need to be careful.
You're
not in control.
Because your life is just a mist that appears for a little while and vanishes away. Why hate and covet and kill over something that could be gone just like that? That's what James is. And that's hard to argue with the with the reasoning behind that. Now you see that there are four guidelines toward a view of life that can allow you to let go of what you need to let go of and hang on to what you need to hang on to. And I think a good lesson somewhere in that for each one of us. I appreciate you being here with us today. Hope everybody has a good day and a good week. Yes.
I have this last verse circled in my...
One comment.
This 17th, because we think of sin as being something we've done bad.
All right.
And this points out there's more to it than that.
All right, everybody listen just a second. I meant to point this out as a way in which the beginning of this chapter and the end of it are tied together also. If at the beginning of it, sin is an active thing where people are seeking to destroy whoever stands in their way, at the end of the chapter, you have the sinful, the passive sort of sinful attitude of knowing to do good, but not doing it, you see. And that can make a mess out of life just like the first can. So that's a good point. Thanks for reminding us. Everybody have a good week.